Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 1 Samuel chapter 26. I'm going to do the whole chapter, verses 1 through 25. We're going to see David sparing Saul's life at Hakalah. The second time he's spared Saul's life, he's on the run from Saul, which is taken up starting with chapter 21 all the way to where we are now in chapter 26. David is on the run from the cave of Adullam in Philistia, then to the city of Keilah, right south of there, then from Keilah. David goes to Ziph, the wilderness of Ziph around Horesh and Hakalah, which is where we are today, Hakalah. I'll go over the geography in just a minute. He then goes to En-Gedi, at the cave of En-Gedi. He spares Saul's life when Saul was relieving himself against the wall in the cave there, 1 Samuel 24, then 1 Samuel 25. Samuel goes to Maon and meets Abigail, and Nabal, her husband, the fool, dies, and he marries Abigail. And so here we are, still in the wilderness, Saul still chasing David, and we're at a place called Hakalah. So we start now in 1 Samuel 26:1. Then the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is not David hiding on the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon?" Lots of places here. First of all, Gibeah, that's easy. That's 3 miles north of Jerusalem. That's Saul's hometown, where the government was. Now we need to remember where Hebron is. There's a road from Hebron down southeast. From Hebron southeast all the way to En-Gedi on the shores of the Dead Sea is the general area where David is running from Saul. So if you look at the road from Hebron, go down about 4 miles southeast, you get to a place called Ziph. Now the Ziphites were opposed to David. We'll talk about them. We already have in a previous audio. We'll talk about them again. Now while you're at Ziph, if you keep going south on the road, you hit another, I would say, 4 miles. You hit Carmel. And Carmel is the intersection of a road that if you take the left there and go due east about 10 miles, maybe a little bit more, about 12 miles, you hit En-Gedi, which is a luxurious place right on the coast of the western coast of the Dead Sea, halfway between the northern tip and the southern tip. So the geography is fairly easy here. And it's all wilderness in this area, Ziph and Carmel. Now go back, and now if you go down the road from Carmel, you go 1 mile, you hit Maon. That's where Abigail was from. Carmel was where David married Abigail, a little bit to the north of Maon. Now keep going north up the road, going back toward Hebron. You go 4 miles back to Ziph, the same Ziph I just told you about. And if you go to the east about 4 miles, right in the hills there is Hakalah. And that's where our story is going to take place today. David is going to spare Saul's life at Hakalah. So verse 1 says, the Ziphites came to Saul at Gibeah. So the Ziphites go back up through Hebron all the way up to Jerusalem, up to Gibeah, and they fink on David. David's hiding in the hill country of Hakalah. Now the Ziphites have already done that before. In 1 Samuel 23:19 through 20, this is after David had left the city of Keilah, having saved it, and he fled. He went to Ziph and the Ziphites in 1 Samuel 23:19-20. We read this. Then Ziphites came up to Saul at Gibeah, saying, "Is David not hiding with us in the strongholds at Horesh on the hill of Hakalah, which is on the south of Jeshimon? Now then, O king, come down according to all the desire of your soul to do so, and our part shall be to surrender him into the king's hands." So the Ziphites were not David-friendly. Now after that betrayal, Saul sent his army down. David retreats south from the area of Ziph. Horesh is to the southwest of Ziph. Hakalah is to the east of Ziph. Ziph's in the middle. So in that area, David retreats down the road to Maon, and Saul comes at him, coming around the mountain, splits his forces up, sends one flank around one side of the mountain, one flank around the other. David's about to be trapped, and then a message comes to Saul, says, "The Philistines are after you, Saul, in your rear." So Saul returns to deal with the Philistines, and David escapes, and then goes to En-Gedi, where he delivers Saul's life for the first time by cutting off a piece of his cloak, showing it to him and saying, "I could have killed you, Saul." So the Ziphites have already been hostile to David. Now the question is, why? Well, Saul could have asked the Ziphites to spy on his way home from En-Gedi when Saul is all sweetness and light toward David because David has spared his life. But then he might have turned treacherous and said, "Hey, I'm back home. I'm going by the way of Ziph. Hey, you Ziphites, how about keep your eye on David for me?" Or maybe Ziphites just inform Saul on their own. They had already attempted to betray David once, as I just said, in chapter 23, so maybe they would fear David's vengeance, and now they've got no choice. They're stuck. Oh, David's going to come get us, so we better get Saul down here to take David out. Now, let's look at David's motives for hiding in the vicinity of the Ziphites. Here are some options. One is the Ziphites knew that Saul had let David go in peace. Saul had made David swear at En-Gedi that David would not cut off Saul's descendants. When they met and talked there, we read in 1 Samuel 24, 21 through 22, first part of the verse, Saul says to David, "Therefore swear to me by the Lord that you will not cut off my descendants or wipe out my name from my father's family." So David swore to Saul. So David's made a vow to Saul. He's not going to hurt him. And so the Ziphites will say, okay, David's not going to cut off Saul's descendants, so he won't hurt us, Ziphites, who are in league with Saul. Well, that logic is probably not going to work. The Ziphites know of Saul's inconstancy as well as David knew it. They probably well knew that Saul was going to forget his vow of peace with David at En-Gedi, and that Saul would soon be coming after David, and thus put the Ziphites in trouble because David might come after them if they didn't get rid of David. So David's probably not relying on the Ziphites, relying on the peace he had made with Saul. So that wouldn't give him any peace. But he's still there in the vicinity of the Ziphites. Well, in that area, it's easy to retreat into the wilderness on the first sign of trouble because it's all wilderness area, by the way. And by the way, it's near Jeshimon, which I didn't mention. It means waste. It's probably not a proper name. It just means the waste or wilderness on which the plateau of Ziph looks down, according to Easton's dictionary. So he's in the wilderness. He can go into the wilderness if Saul comes and hide in the rocks and the cracks and the caves again. He's also near Maon, which is right down the road from Maon, which is right down the road from Ziph, a couple, 5 or 6 miles. And Abigail's got money. She's got male relatives. She's got wealth. And so it makes sense for David to remain in the area of Ziph, even though the Ziphites were thinking on him to Saul. We go now to 1 Samuel 26, verses 2 through 4. So Saul arose and went down to the wilderness of Ziph, having with him 3,000 chosen men of Israel, to search for David in the wilderness of Ziph. Saul camped in the hill of Hakalah, which is before Jeshimon, beside the road, and David was staying in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies, and he knew that Saul was definitely coming. Well, Saul arose in verse 2 and went down to Ziph. His soft attitude towards David at the cave of En-Gedi in chapter 24, that didn't last too long, did it? He picks 3,000 men. They're choice men, chosen men, picked troops, crack troops, a lot more than David's 600. But on the other hand, David and his men had certain advantages. They knew the country by now, and they were hidden in a harsh wilderness. So David still got a fighting chance, besides the fact that the Holy Spirit had left Saul and that God is preserving David providentially to make him king. Now, David saw in verse 3 that Saul was coming. We don't know how he saw. He perceived in some fashion that Saul was coming. Jonathan may have given him intelligence. Jonathan might have sent message down to David, "Hey, my dad's coming to get you again." At any rate, however he perceived that Saul was coming, David sent out spies to confirm that intelligence, and the spies confirmed it. Yes, David, unfortunately, he's coming after you again. We go to verse 5, 1 Samuel 26. David then arose and came to the place where Saul had camped. Remember, this is at Hakalah, right east of Ziph, about 4 or 5 miles. And David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army, and Saul was lying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him. Abner, of course, is Saul's first son. He's the commander-in-chief of the army. So there's 3,000 people sleeping, camped around Saul, and Saul's in the center. Again, that's for security, greater security. Also, it's a place of honor. We go now to 1 Samuel 26, verses 6 through 7. Then David said to Ahimelech the Hittite and to Abishai the son of Zeruiah, Joab's brother, saying, "Who will go down with me to Saul in the camp?" And Abishai said, "I will go down with you." So David and Abishai came to the people by night, and behold, the people means the 3,000 soldiers, and behold, Saul lay sleeping inside the circle of the camp with his spear stuck in the ground at his head, and Abner and the people were lying around him. All right, this Ahimelech the Hittite, apparently a military guy. Well, they were all military guys, so the 600, but he was one of the leaders probably. We don't know too much about him. There's a question as why would a Hittite be with David? since David, of course, is an Israelite, well, he could have been a Hittite by birth who became a proselyte, or he could have been an Israelite dwelling among the Hittites in Canaan, and the name Hittite was given to him. In other words, going the other way from Israel to the Hittites or from Hittites to Israel. At any rate, he's called a Hittite. Now, the Hittites are mentioned. Remember Uriah, the Hittite that David ended up killing in the future when he was king? The Hittite Empire was in present-day Turkey from about 1700 to 1200 B.C., but there were remnants of the Hittites that kind of leaked out of southeastern Turkey through Syria into the Promised Land. And so the Hittites are a big deal in ancient Near Eastern history, even though now they're just scattered, a scattered ethnic group. Now we've got to take care of some of David's family here. David had a sister named Zeruiah, and Zeruiah had three sons, and all three sons show up in the future history of David and the kingdom, so we need to remember her. She's mentioned in 1 Chronicles 2:15 through 16, mentioning David's brothers, Ozem, the sixth brother of son of Jesse, and then David the seventh. And remember, one might have died in there, so David is sometimes said to be the eighth. But at any rate, verse 16 says, and there, that means the sons of Jesse, their sisters were Zeruiah and Abigail. And the three sons of Zeruiah were Abishai, Joab, and Asahel, all three of which will show up later. Right now we're dealing with Abishai because he's going to go with David into the camp at Halakai and scare Saul within an inch of his life when he realized that he could have been killed. So that's Abishai. Now Abishai had a brother, the son of Zeruiah, named Joab, and another brother named Asahel. Now Joab is really going to show up later on, so I'm going to give you a preview, biographical preview of Joab. This is from gotquestions.org. Joab was a son of Zeruiah, King David's sister, and was therefore one of David's nephews. Joab's brothers were two of David's brave warriors, Abishai and Asahel. So remember, I just remember it this way, AJA, Abishai, Joab, and Asahel. Joab was positioned as commander of David's armies because of his victory over the Jebusites, resulting in the possession of the city of Jerusalem. Okay, so Joab helped take over Jerusalem. That's a big deal. It was through this victory that Jerusalem became the city of David. Joab fought and won many battles for the king, but his personal lack of self-control was problematic. In a war against the forces of Ishbosheth, that's Saul's son and successor, Joab's brother Asahel, that's the other Asahel I told you about, Joab's brother Asahel was killed by Abner, the commander of Ishbosheth's armies, Abner being Saul's first cousin. Joab was furious and pursued Abner to kill him, but Abner escaped. Later, after Abner swore allegiance to David, Joab's fuse blew, and his desire to avenge his brother's blood drove him to deceive and murder Abner. This action deeply grieved David, but the king felt unable to bring justice against the mighty Joab. Instead, David pronounced a curse over Joab and his future descendants. May his blood fall on the head of Joab and on his whole family. May Joab's family never be without someone who has a running sore or leprosy, or who leans on a crutch, or who falls by the sword, who lacks food. David was good at his imprecations. So you see, David and Joab are going to fall out. And Joab's going to end up murdering Abner, Saul's first cousin, head of the troops of Israel after Saul dies. And Abner's going to kill Asahel, Joab's brother, Zeruiah's son, David's nephew. So there's a little family history of David here. So David asked Abishai, who will go down with me to Saul in the camp? Well, he asked Abishai and Ahimelech. Abishai said, I will go down. So David and Abishai came to the people, saw Saul sleeping inside the circle of the camp, and his spear stuck in the ground. Now when David said, which one of you two, Ahimelech, the Hittite, or Abishai, why does he only want to take one of the two? Well, because taking only one companion would mean better secrecy. Now this was a very bold maneuver, to sneak into a camp of 3,000 people. Well, how did they pull that off? Well, they went at night, when most of the 3,000 were asleep, and it was a deep sleep. We see that in 1 Samuel 26:12, in a couple of verses, a few verses. So David took the spear and the jug of water from beside Saul's head, and they went away, but no one saw or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. Now, the first question I ask is, well, did the sentries fall asleep too? Everybody fell asleep? And some people say this is obviously supernatural. I'm not so sure. Sentries, of course, are looking for armies on the move. They wouldn't expect two people to sneak into an armed camp. They probably weren't even hardly watching. They didn't hear it. And David and Abishai sneaked through the sentries. Then all the 3,000 are sleeping. They also were not expecting anybody to come. Remember, this is rough territory, so David and Abishai went through the rough territory between the sleeping sentries and came up and sneaked up on Saul. So I don't think this we need to take this as supernatural. It's definitely providential, of course, but I don't know about supernaturally miraculous. So anyway, they get there to Saul, Abishai and David do, and they see Saul's spear stuck in the ground. Why? Well, a spear is like a scepter. It's a symbol of Saul's kingship. But also the spear would be stuck in the ground so that if Saul were awakened, he could jump up and grab his spear and use it for immediate defense. We go now to 1 Samuel 26, verses 8 through 10. Then Abishai said to David, "Today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now therefore, please let me strike him with the spear on the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him the second time." But David said to Abishai, "Do not destroy him, for who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt?" David also said, "As the Lord lives, surely the Lord will strike him, or his day will come that he dies, or he will go down into battle and perish." When Abishai says, "I will not strike Saul the second time," he means a second blow will not be necessary because I'm going to get him with the first stroke. With one stroke, he calls it. Wham! Pin him to the ground, the end of Saul. It would have been so easy. Now, you know, Abishai didn't really discuss how they were going to run from there once they speared Saul, and then I'm sure people would have woke up and looked, "Oh my gosh, the king's dead." I guess Abishai is assuming that they're all going to panic because their commander-in-chief, who they probably didn't respect very much, had just gotten killed, and then they would turn themselves over to David. Maybe so, but I think he's kind of risky. But Abishai is delivered from having to find out because David holds him up and says, "No, don't do it. Who can stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed?" That's famous phrase that was also used in Gedi, 1 Samuel 24:6. David says to his men, "I swear before the Lord, I would never do such a thing to my Lord, the Lord's anointed. I will never kill him," in other words. "I will never lift my hand against him since he is the Lord's anointed." The Lord's anointed, that reminds me of all these charismatic preachers when they run their little dictatorships, their little quasi-cults where they tell everybody what to do and how to think, and then people naturally start complaining about it in the church, and then the charismatic pastor, who is not one of several elders, who is unchecked, who is a little dictator, says, "Don't touch the Lord's anointed." And so it's sort of left a bad phrase in my mouth because I saw so much of that, but it's a good phrase. It's in the Bible. And the Lord's anointed was Saul because he had been anointed by Samuel as king by God. And so he's not going to kill David. So he says, "Look, you're going to be guilt. If we kill him, I can't be without guilt. I will have guilt if I do that." Now, let's see what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about David's attitude here. Quote, "David's magnanimity soared far above the notions of his followers. Though Saul's cruelty and perfidy and general want of right principle had sunk him to a low pitch of degradation, yet that was no reason for David's imitating him in doing wrong. Besides, he, Saul, was the sovereign. David was a subject. Though God had rejected Saul from the kingdom, it was in every way the best and most dutiful course. Instead of precipitating Saul's fall by imbruing their hands in his blood," imbruing, that's a good word, must be an old-fashioned English word, "imbruing their hands in his blood and thereby contracting the guilt of a great crime, to wait the awards of that retributive providence which sooner or later would take him off by some sudden and mortal blow. He who, with impetuous haste, was going to exterminate Nabal, meekly spared Saul." Well, that's fancy language of saying regicide's a dangerous business, because when you kill a king, there's always supporters of that king who will then be disloyal to you in the next regime and will try to revolt against you or cause you trouble or conspire against you. So David is well aware that Saul was the rightful king, and he did not want to commit regicide. He wanted God to take care of him, of Saul. And then David goes to vengeance's mind, says the Lord. He says in verse 10, "Surely the Lord will strike him. As the Lord lives," which of course is an oath, "as surely as God lives and God surely lives." He's taking an oath to convince Abishai of the truth of what he's about to say. Abishai, either God's going to strike him, or he's just going to die naturally. A day will come that he dies, or he'll go in to fight a battle and he'll get killed in battle. God will take care of him. We don't need to stab him with his spear right now. Now, David had said there would be guilt if he had stabbed Saul. Guilt of what? Well, let's say that David did that. Will we charge him with murder? Adam Clark says murder David could not consider to be lawful. This would have been taking the matter out of God's hand, and this David would not do. So Adam Clark suggests that it would be murder to kill Saul. I don't think so. How would it have been murder? It was a military situation. There were two armies fighting each other. David's on the defense. Wouldn't be murder. It'd be a killing in war, justified killing. But just because it was justified, in my humble opinion, that doesn't mean it was a smart thing to do, because David would have been guilty of regicide if he had killed Saul, and it seems to me that's what David was worried about. He probably wouldn't have scrupled against killing any other military commander, but Saul, he was king. As John Gill says, since Saul was king and appointed to that office by the Lord and was anointed by his order for it and invested with it by him, his person was sacred and not to be touched, nor could his life be taken away by any without guilty of a very great crime indeed, which it might be justly expected the Lord would resent and punish. Well, even if it wouldn't be regicide, something blameworthy, David apparently thought it was, but even if it weren't, pragmatically, it would have been foolish for David to kill Saul. Politically, the people would have thought that David had committed regicide. His kingdom probably never would have been legitimate or considered legitimate. And by not killing Saul, David appeared magnanimous. At the same time, without appearing weak. I mean, nobody's going to accuse David of weak. He just sneaked through 3,000 people in centuries. He put himself back in danger by not killing Saul. So nobody's going to say he's weak. He's still being pursued by a superior force in the desert. Nobody's going to say he's being weak, but he was also magnanimous. So politically, it was a smart thing to do not to kill Saul. Now, when he says in verse 10, we don't need to kill Saul because the Lord will strike him, perhaps as an alternative way for God to deal with Saul. What does that mean? The Lord will strike him? Well, it could be a direct blow from God without any intermediate natural cause, or it could be an indirect blow from God like a sickness. But either way, God's either supernaturally or providentially going to take care of Saul. We go down to 1 Samuel 26, verses 11 and 12. David continues talking to Abishai. The Lord forbid that I should stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointing, but now please take the spear that is at his head and the jug of water and let us go. I assume he's whispering this now because everybody's sleeping. So David took the spear and the jug of water from beside Saul's head, and they went away. But no one saw or knew it, nor did any awake, for they were all asleep, because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. Now, what's this jug of water doing at Saul's head? Well, it could be, of course, drinking water, but also it was a custom of Jews to purify themselves in bed, as John Gill says. For example, if they had a nocturnal pollution and a seminal emission, they could immediately purify themselves right on the spot. Now, David ends up taking the spear and the jug of water, and this seems kind of strange, because in verse 11, David asked Abishai to take the spear and the jug, but Abishai doesn't take it because in verse 12, David took the spear and the jug. Here's some options to perhaps explain this. Option number one, Abishai could have been peeved that David wouldn't kill Saul like Abishai wanted to, and thus he said, I'm not going to take the jug and the spear. And so David was forced to take it. Option number two, David could have changed his mind. He was afraid to let Abishai have the spear so close to Saul, thinking that Abishai might kill Saul. So after he asked him to do it, he said, hold on, maybe it's better that I get it, so you don't forget yourself and stab the king while he's sleeping. Option number three, it could be that David was the principal who took the items, Abishai being the agent who actually took the items. So David took the spear through Abishai, his agent. That seems like saying, I built the house, but actually it was my contractor that built the house. At any rate, they took it, and of course nobody woke up because a sound sleep from the Lord had fallen on them. I've already said that I don't think that necessarily has to be supernatural. It could have been, but 3,000 of those soldiers could have been bivouacked further out with the intention of stopping an army, not two people trying to sneak through rough terrain. So Saul's camp could have been in the center of those 3,000 people guarded by just a few, and they were asleep. And they could have been sneaked by. But at any rate, whether it was natural or whether it was supernatural, whether it was supernatural or providential, either way, it was from the Lord. God was in control of all of this. 1 Samuel 26, verses 13 through 14. Then David crossed over to the other side and stood on top of the mountain at a distance with a large area between them. David called to the people and to Abner, the son of Ner, saying, Will you not answer Abner? Then Abner replied, Who are you who calls to the king? So David's standing on top of the mountain, one of those crags there, with a valley between him and Hakalah, where Saul is sleeping. Why would David do that? Why would he retreat to such a place? Well, his voice could be still heard at a large distance. At the same time, he would be safe from Saul waking up and nabbing him. On a clear, still night, a voice could be heard a long, long way. Here's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown on that. Quote, "The extraordinary purity and elasticity of the air in Palestine enable words to be distinctly heard that are addressed by a speaker from the top of one hill to people on that of another, from which it is separated by a deep intervening ravine. Hostile parties could thus speak to each other while completely beyond the reach of each other's attack. It results from the peculiar features of the country in many of the mountain districts," and this was a mountainous district. Now, apparently, Abner didn't answer David because David said, "Will you not answer Abner?" Remember, Abner is the head of Saul's armies, Saul's first cousin. Why did Abner not respond? Well, he could have been asleep when David first called, and then he could have been groggy and said, "What's going on here? What's going on?" He just not answered. Or it could have been he was wide awake, but he was going to keep quiet until he figured out, who is this guy that's calling us? Why would one person call me the leader of the army? What's going on? We go down to 1 Samuel 26, verses 15 through 16. "So David said to Abner, 'Are you not a man? And who is like you in Israel? Why then have you not guarded your lord the king? For one of the people came to destroy the king your lord.'" That would be Abishai. "'This thing that you have done is not good. As the Lord lives, all of you must surely die, because you did not guard your lord, the Lord's anointed. And now see where the king's spear is and the jug of water that was at his head.'" Now, why would David stand there and shout to the enemy camp? Well, one thing it would do is create dissension between Saul and Abner, because Saul might think, "Yeah, I don't know, this David out here who's yelling at me, he's right. My commander-in-chief did not protect me, and I could have been killed." And so Saul then would be upset with Abner. Another reason why David would shout to the enemy camp was to show once again that David had no intention of killing Saul. He said, "Look here, I could have killed him, but I didn't. It was me who stole that spear and jug, which is now missing. Remember, it was by the king's head. Well, I've got it now, and I didn't hurt Saul. Second time, once at the cave of Engedi, and now here at Hakalah." Now, David says to Abner in verse 15, "Are you not a man?" And what he means is, "Are you not a valiant man?" In other words, what kind of a pussy are you, Abner? You have not acted worthy of your character, nor of your office. Adam Clark says Abner's negligence was actually worthy of death. Clark tries to mitigate Abner's negligence by saying that that negligence resulted from God's supernaturally putting Abner to sleep, so it wasn't really his fault. I don't think you can put the blame on God here. Abner should have stayed awake. And besides, like I said, that's not necessarily that God interfered with no ordinary means of providence here. He was sleeping, and he let David and Abishai get through, and so David's mocking him for it. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown says, quote, "The circumstance of David having penetrated to the center of the encampment through the circular rows of the sleeping soldiers constituted the point of this sarcastic taunt." David in verse 15 says, "Who is like you in Israel?" In other words, is there anybody in Israel besides the king who has a higher position than you, Abner? You're a big shot, and you couldn't even guard him while he's sleeping. "One of the people came to destroy Saul, the king your lord." Of course, that was Abishai. Abishai did come with the intent to destroy Saul, even though David did not. So David uses Abishai to make Abner look bad. "Got an assassin coming after your charge, and you let him get killed." Reminds me of one of the Secret Service agents that was guarding John F. Kennedy when Kennedy got assassinated. I saw him when he was an old man before he died in an interview on YouTube, and he said it was with him every day for the rest of his life. He didn't protect the president. And so David's probably going to appeal to Abner's sense of guilt here. We go now to 1 Samuel 26, verses 17 through 18. "Then Saul recognized David's voice and said, 'Is this your voice, my son David?' And David said, 'It is my voice, my lord the king.' David also said, 'Why then is my lord pursuing his servant? For what have I done, or what evil is in my hand?'" Now Saul recognized David's voice, even though Abner had not recognized David's voice. Saul did. And then he calls him my son. Such sweet words from a lying, oath-breaking, murderous SOB. My son. He might have been trying to show how close he was to David, or he might have been referring to the fact that David was actually his son-in-law because David had married his daughter Michal. David responds in equally nice words. He says, "It is my voice, my lord the king." Note how respectful of Saul's authority David is. And then he says, "I got a question for you, Saul. I'm your servant. Why are you pursuing me? What have I done? What evil have I done?" And he had a perfectly good ground to stand on because he hadn't done a darn thing to Saul. He protected him. He could have killed him twice. He didn't do it. He played his harp in front of him when he was possessed with an evil spirit, Saul was. He killed Philistines for Saul. He killed Goliath for Saul. And this is the thanks that David is getting. So he had good grounds to stand on. We go now to 1 Samuel 26:19. David continues talking to Saul. "Now therefore, please let my lord the king listen to the words of his servant David. If the Lord has stirred you up, Saul, against me, let Yahweh accept an offering. But if it is men, cursed are they before the Lord." In other words, if it's men who stirred you up against me, "cursed are they before the Lord, for they have driven me out today so that I would have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord, saying, 'Go serve other gods.'" Now, it's a little bit unclear what David is referring to here when he tells Saul, "If the Lord has stirred you up against me, let God accept an offering." Well, the easiest way to take that is David is saying, "Look, Saul, if I've done something wrong and God has stirred you up to punish me for whatever I've done wrong, I don't know what I've done wrong. I haven't done anything wrong. But if that's true, if you think that's true, and God has done that, well, let him accept an offering instead of you chasing me down and killing me. There's no point in it." That's the easiest way to take that. Some people say that, however, David is saying, "Saul, if the Lord has stirred you up against me because he's taken his spirit away from you, he's put in an evil spirit in you, and that evil spirit has then come up against me, let Yahweh accept an offering from you, Saul, to take care of your sin. And then once that'll be taken care of, you won't be need to be chasing me anymore. Your sin will be taken care of." I think the context is better to say that what David means here, "Saul, if God has stirred you up against me to punish me for something," speaking hypothetically, of course, because David didn't think there was anything that he had done wrong. "But if that's the case, well then, Saul, if you think that, you might be wrong to think that, but if you think that, just give God an offering, confess your sin. There's no point in all this killing and chasing each other through the wilderness here. But on the other hand, Saul, if it's men, i.e. your advisors, who have pushed you into this bad situation, cursed are they before the Lord." Oh, David loved to implicate people, I tell you. Now notice what David is doing. He's very gently trying to tell Saul that the whole situation was not David's fault. Either it was God that stirred up Saul against David because God put a demon in Saul and that's what did it, or because God is trying to get Saul to punish David for whatever reason. It was either God that did it, or it was the men, your advisors, who did it. But isn't that interesting, Saul? I have not directly accused you of doing it. That takes some of the opprobrium off Saul by the way he phrased it. David shows himself here a wise diplomat and politician. And, of course, this is the old thing, blame the administration, but don't blame the president. Well, the Biden administration didn't take care of the southern border. His people in his administration, if Biden had just known better about what was going on, he would have fixed the horrible situation, that kind of thing. That's been going on since, and especially in English history or medieval history, constantly. "Oh, it's not the king. Oh, we're not fighting the king." Even if it's a popular uprising, "Oh, we're not fighting a king. We're fighting his lousy advisors." Over and over again that happens. And David's using that time-honored ploy. So he says, "Cursed are your advisors who are advising you to chase me. They've driven me out, so I would have no attachment with the inheritance of the Lord." That would be, well, it could be the land of Canaan in general. It could be Gibeah, where he lived with Saul, or it could be his hometown of Bethlehem. But at any rate, he's not living in either one of those three places. Well, he's in the land of Canaan, I guess. But he's in the wilderness. And then he says, "And because I'm detached from the land of Canaan, the land of promise, I'll have to go serve other gods, because that's what's in these other lands that you're driving me out to, is idolatry. So you're not only driving me away from the land, you're driving me away from Yahweh, the God of the land. So these guys are bad, and that's why they're cursed." And again, David, he's a political figure, and he is allowed to talk like that. He's speaking as the head of God's Old Testament theocracy. He's not really talking he's not really treating this as a personal matter. It's a matter of opposition to God himself. He was anointed by God and saw you're trying to screw that up. Or these advisors of yours are trying to screw that up. Now, if you do say that David is speaking out of personal grievance, and I don't think he was, but if he was, you could say, well, he was just wrong to do so. Or you could say he was right to do so. He was living in a different dispensation than Jesus was, where Jesus said, turn the other cheek. But Jesus was not talking about military stuff or political stuff, governmental stuff. He was talking about private vengeance. I don't think the Sermon on the Mount has anything to do with this. David had every right, as the head of God's theocracy, well, he had the right to kill Saul. And he certainly had a right to put an imprecation, a curse, on Saul's wicked advisors. And again, it was hypothetical anyway. It was a hypothetical curse. We go down to 1 Samuel 26:20. David continues to implore Saul. Now then, do not let my blood fall to the ground away from the presence of the Lord, David continues, for the king of Israel has come out to search for a single flea, just as one hunts a partridge in the mountains. This is two good metaphors here. David doesn't want his blood to fall away from the presence of the Lord. The NIV and the Holman Christian Study Bible say far from the presence of the Lord. And of course, that means far from the land of promise. Presence of the Lord is obviously God is present. He's omnipresent. But what David is meaning here is that he's away from the land of promise. The King James has, don't let my blood fall to the ground. Well, it has, as far as these prepositions are concerned, it says, don't let me die before the presence of the Lord. In other words, that wouldn't be the land of the Lord. It would be God up in heaven seeing this. God will see my murder and avenge it. I don't think so. Most of the other translations have far from. David is worrying about being far away in the wilderness, away from his home in Canaan land. And then he compares himself to a single flea that Saul is chasing. Now, David has already used this metaphor with Saul at the cave of En-Gedi, 1 Samuel 24:14. Who is the king of Israel, Saul? Who have you come after, Saul? What are you chasing after? A dead dog? A flea? So David has compared himself to a dog, a flea here, and a partridge. And they're four great metaphors. A dead dog, a stinking dog that can't hurt anybody because he's dead, or a flea. And let's look at the flea metaphor. Fleas hop from place to place and are hard to catch. Well, that's just like David was doing. He was hopping from place to place in the wilderness there, from crag to crag, from cave to cave, from rock to rock. Saul couldn't catch him. Have you ever tried to catch a flea? Kind of tough to catch. I have, actually, but it's a fruitless endeavor. And fleas are also poor, weak, and insignificant, just like David was. So David calls himself a flea and also a partridge. You're hunting me like a partridge in the mountains. Now, that's not so obvious what the metaphor means, but Adam Clark explains it. He says, quote, people in the East, in hunting the partridge and other game birds, pursue them till observing them becoming languid and fatigued after they have been put up two or three times, they rush upon the birds stealthily and knock them down with bludgeons. It was exactly in this manner that Saul was pursuing David. He drove him from time to time from his hiding place, hoping to render him weary of his life or obtain an opportunity of accomplishing his destruction. So we go down to verses 21 through 25 and we'll finish this audio. Then Saul said, I have sinned. Return, my son David, for I will not harm you again, because my life was precious in your sight this day. Behold, I have played the fool and have committed a serious error. David replied, behold, the spear of the king. Now let one of the young men come over and take it. And he says, behold, I'm sure he held it up. The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness. Remember, they're talking on two crags over a valley. The Lord will repay each man for his righteousness and his faithfulness, for the Lord delivered you into my hand today, but I refuse to stretch out my hand against the Lord's anointed. Now behold, as your life was highly valued in my sight this day, so may my life be highly valued in the sight of the Lord, and may he deliver me from all distress. Then Saul said to David, blessed are you, my son David. You will accomplish much and surely prevail. So David went on his way, and Saul returned to his place. That would be Gibeah that Saul went back to. Now, in verse 21, when Saul says, I have sinned, this is the first time Saul has acknowledged his sin in pursuing David, as John Gill says, but he really had no true repentance in his heart. He just had a guilty conscience. Now, note the effect of all this on Saul's men. None of them offered to go and take David. When they listened to this speech, they saw that Saul was abandoned by God. They knew that spear and jug was by Saul's head when he was sleeping, and somebody, David and Abishai, came in there and took it. They knew that the kingdom of Israel under the tribe of Benjamin was toast, especially when their own king is confessing his fault. Saul says, go back, my son David. In other words, leave me, leave to wherever you're going, I guess back to Mayon or Carmel or wherever, leave from here my son David. Once again, Saul appeals to his previously intimate connection with David, either as a close confidant or as a son-in-law. But note now that David is really not a son-in-law anymore because Saul had given Michal away to Palti, also known as Paltiel. I mentioned that in a previous audio. So, at any rate, he's still calling him son. Now, David replies and says, come get your spear, Saul. It's a symbol that I didn't kill you. And then David says, God will repay each man for his righteousness and faithfulness. He's talking about himself. God will repay me for being righteous and faithful and not killing you. David then says, may my life be highly valued in the sight of the Lord. Again, it's all of the Lord's going to bless me for doing this. Adam Clark says, quote, there is a vast deal of dignity in this speech of David, arising from a consciousness of his own innocence. He neither begs his life from Saul, nor offers one argument to prevail upon him to desist from his felonious attempts, but refers the whole matter to God as the judge and vindicator of oppressed innocence. Now, when David says, send one of your men over here, Saul, get this spear, that would be especially meaningful if that spear was used as a scepter, more than just a weapon, but a scepter, a symbol of rule and authority. David would be making it clear that he's not trying to take sovereignty away from David. He's giving it back. Take sovereignty away from Saul. He's giving it back. He's giving the sovereignty back to Saul. David's plan, of course, was to let God take out Saul through natural means, not through him. Now, David said, you get one of your men to take the spear back, because David probably still didn't trust Saul, and for good reason. He didn't want Saul to come get a spear back, just one of Saul's men. That's probably the same spear that Saul threw at David three times. And yet David was still magnanimous enough to return that spear to Saul. Ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished chapter 26. David having spared Saul's life at Hakalah, Saul having gone back to Gibeah, David now is ready in chapter 27 to flee to the Philistines. He probably got tired of getting chased by Saul around Ziph. Ziph and Engedi and Maon and Carmel in that area, so he's headed west to the Philistines. I hope you stay tuned to continue our story of David on the Lamb, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.